Welcome to Wordsworthing, Season 1, Episode 1, a podcast concerned with all things literary in America. To tell you a little bit more about what Wordsworthing is, here's one of our podcasters, Benjamin Tosh.
Wordsworthing is a podcast about trying to cobble together said podcast with a totally ignorant man who grew up in a trailer in South Mississippi.
Thank you, Ben. That's fantastic and probably very accurate.
No worries.
At this point, being our first episode, or rather our second try at our first episode, I think it's probably appropriate for us to introduce ourselves. Nick DeGuerra, take it away.
Yeah, we did this once already, right?
What did I say? We did, but we don't have it anymore.
Yeah, that's true. I'm Nick. I'm a man who has whittled away at his own inner self-worth until such a point it is, if it can be negative, I've reached some kind of implosion. So that's working out.
Outstanding. Thank you for joining us, Nick. Ben Tosh, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Ben Tosh is a man who spends a lot of time in Freezyville on the internet.
And my name is Dan Mickelson, and I'm a guy who believes that my worldview probably should not extend beyond lunchtime. So Ben, Nick, and Dan all know each other from a Masters of Fine Arts program from the University of Alaska Anchorage. We all have varying degrees of that degree. And we're here to bring you Wordsworthing, wherein we will investigate the state of literature within these great United States and other issues related to the fact that Wordsworth and Samuel Taylor Coleridge used to take long walks together, which we call Wordsworthing.
Excellent.
This particular podcast comes to you recorded just a few days before our nation's Independence Day, July 4, and not too long after Father's Day, which was a day we all participated in and spoke quite a bit about in our last attempt at this podcast, which has gone into the ether.
Yeah, that was a pod crap.
That was not a podcast. It was a pod crap, yes. So independence, what does independence mean? Independence as people, we do it by breaking away from our families as we grow. As parents, we see it happen with our own children as they strive to become their own people. It happens for nations. And so this first episode of Wordsworthing will be concerned with the theme of independence. And that leads nicely into our examination of the first story we are going to critique, which is something that we're going to do in every episode. We're going to pick something from the general mainstream annals of literature. And in order to investigate where literature is at, one of the places that our affinity leads us is to the short story and to things that are published in very literary magazines. And I just Googled best literary magazine, and there's actually a point score rating that Google returned to me, and the number one most literary magazine in the United States is The New Yorker, according to the Google. So we took a story from this most recent issue of The New Yorker, and the story is called Upside Down Cake by a gentleman named Paul Theroux. Paul Theroux is an author, a novelist, is that correct? And also a travel writer. I want to make sure I get that right.
Yes, I think he's a novelist, well-known-ish.
Literarily well-known. Great.
Yeah.
So The New Yorker has published this new piece by Mr. Theroux. It's a short story of about 4,400 words, and I'm going to read the opening paragraph because I think it... Actually, I'm going to read the opening two paragraphs because I think it really gives the flavor of the piece. Every visit to an aged parent is in the nature of a farewell. When I got a save-the-date postcard for Mother's 90th, I thought, oh, God, a birthday can seem like a kind of funeral. Then I saw an opportunity and said yes and made my arrangements and looked forward to the event. But the private function room at the Happy Clam was funereal, with bouquets and long faces, Rose with her back turned, Gilbert and Fred conferring, Franny fussing over her son, Jaunty. We all stood gaping and glassy-eyed as though we were about to bury Mother. I had arrived on time, resolved to see it through. The spouses were rattled. Franny's husband, Marvin, ill at ease, out of his security guard uniform. Fred's wife, Irma, sighing and snatching at her hair, Rose's husband, Walter, monkeying with a camera as a way of snubbing everyone else. Jaunty's little girl, Jilly, was the center of attention, the adults shouting at her as she ran back and forth. So first of all, can we talk about the happy clam? I feel like I've been to the happy clam.
You just revealed a fucking, like, a point of plot that I hadn't noticed before that totally fucks the entire ending of the story up. Like, the logistics. Like, where is the logic here? Like, Spock's logic. Oh, I should not be talking. I don't have anything good to say.
You shouldn't, because there's nothing good to say about this.
I'm sorry, I don't.
I think that's fantastic. So Nick and Ben are both making the point that Upside Down Cake Ball by Paul Theroux has some issues.
I found a good line.
Where?
Do it. Because we do when we critique our own work, when we learned, we went through our program and considered ourselves literary, we did always try and find the good in everything. So we should start with something.
Never considered myself literary. I always considered myself practicing, what is this, mental masturbation? I'd say that's probably what it is.
There's that, too.
Okay, so I think I'm on page 3. And we have the... Fluid began shaking nuts into his hand. "Why is it?" he said, as he rattled the nuts in his fist like a dice before shooting them into his mouth, "that people always do this when they're eating nuts." I can get behind that. It's a really obvious observation that we've probably all made and never said aloud, that I've never read in a story. It doesn't have 77,000 characters in it that I have to figure out what their motive is. It's really simplistic. It's right to the point. It doesn't have extra words. I read this and I don't get aggravated. I feel like, yes, this is what should be happening. This one's working on a very nice level.
Yeah, look, he's got some points here where he turns a phrase, right? He builds a sentence, but the interesting thing to me is that often he actually just builds parts of sentences and then goes sideways later on in the sentence. But I found a number of places where I thought, okay, the writing is very approachable, enjoyable.
I wouldn't say that it's approachable. You would say that it's approachable?
In single lines. Like, on first page, "I had a child named Angela," mother said. "She died. She's in heaven." Okay, that's a nice piece from a 90-year-old. "One would never have known that," Floyd said, "to look at you." Floyd provides some comic relief in places, though he becomes very, very heavy-handed.
Yeah.
Sweet Christ, how can you tell them apart? Sorry.
Okay, so talking about the amount of characters, I diagrammed this because I thought it was important. And in the first paragraph, there are 7 characters. None of them, aside from Mother, who is described as 90... has any sort of marker.
Oh, that's, yeah, in the first for sure, paragraph. For sure.
Second paragraph has another 5. You get so little about them. They're just like place markers, right? Going on. It gets to in the first, like, by the time we're at the paragraph, "We're waiting for hubby." "Oh, here he is," Fred said. You're at, like, 16 people.
Dude, I'm on page... I have a comment here on page 4. At the paragraph said, are starting Fred and Gilbert. Okay. My only comment is, at the very last end of that paragraph, it says, 13 people, 2 sentences, fuck you. Like, I cannot be responsible for keeping track of 13 people with absolutely 0 markers between them. And we have, what do we have here? Fred and Fanny, Jaunty and Jilly, Marvin, Manine, Mother. Like, if you're going to write a lot of character... Oh, I forgot Floyd with Franny, Fred, and Floyd. Like, if you're going to do these things, if you're going to have a lot of characters in there, they each have to be differentiated in some fashion. And sometimes the simplest format is just to change the first letter of each name so that they all sound a little different. I can't keep anybody apart. I mean, that's if you have, like... I think the max, like Raymond Carver did a really good example with what we talk about when we talk about love with four people. Four people is kind of your max in a short story. Yes. I've done eight before. Obviously, no one's published that, so it's a piece of shit. But I at least changed the names of everybody so you could keep them apart and have an individual story and not all of them interacting with each other simultaneously. It's just... It's impossible to keep them separated.
So look, I had a point. I'm sorry to jump in there, but I had a point about this that I thought.
Sorry.
No. It's excellent discussion. I approached it because I've got a strong opinion about how many characters are in a short story, because I think we all kind of come from the same school of thought and we'll get to this later, I'm sure. But it's like Chekhov. And the gun, you can't have a gun and the gun not go off. So characters have to mean something, right? So my original gut take on this was that all these characters were to tell us something about the narrator. So my comment after paragraph two, when I'm sitting there going, holy shit, all I can remember is Happy Clam, and I will never remember all these names and don't care. But my comment was, nice usage of a character list to say more about the narrator. Though, if these characters are to be in any way significant, then this is a mistake.
You know what? So here's the thing about them being mistakes. So along about the Fred and Gilbert sat on either side of Mother paragraph that Nick talked about, I have a note, some allusion, and I think the build-up to this is, some allusion to the Final Supper, but I don't care. And, you know, that's important because before the Final Supper happened, you had all of the Gospels where all the important shit is happening. There's, like, words and words and words and important wisdom that's happening. Here, I just get a bunch of names. He's, like, trying to cut to the chase of a Final Supper scene and make it seem literary that way, and it just doesn't work. And you can make those kind of allusions to, like, Floyd being the Judas, right? He, like, calls everybody out or something like that, and just fuck, it's just shit. It's just shit.
No, I think that's actually a really good point. I think there's not enough room here. So I had two major problems with this story. Let's go back to what Dan said about the writing is agreeable here, right? If you remove the two things that I'm about to bring up, the writing itself is devoid of major errors. It's neither really fresh nor terrible. Like, you could pass through this. Who writes really great literature but doesn't really turn a fresh phrase? Would we put Tobias Wolff in there?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
The stories themselves from the progression of character are very literary, but, like, George Saunders is a really good example. Sentence by sentence broken down, his sentences provide no greater turn in the literary merit. Like, the sentences aren't fresh. If you ever read Wells Tower, like, he wrote a sentence once about shucking a lady's panties down with your thumbs. Now, that's like the usage of the English language in a new way. And on a sentence-by-sentence basis, he does that in a way that seems fresh and is contextual and makes sense. Whereas here, this feels like dictionary value of words, progressively using regular grammar, fine, right? But the two things that piss me off were, one, characters, which we've covered, and then the other, this big reveal of, like, an adopted kid.
Oh, God.
Okay, so... Oh. So, these two things, all of these characters, none of them are going to work without a shit ton of backstory for everybody, right? It doesn't have enough room... Right. This doesn't have enough room to define these people. Like, you can bring everybody into this room later on in the story. So you have all these characters, which if they had a shit ton of backstory, you could put in this room, And the reader would be like, oh, God, finally Floyd and Gilbert and Franny and Marvin right. are all going to get together and fucking it's yeah. going to be that verbal repartee or whatever it is. Like, it's going to be a fight and it's going to be awesome. But you don't have any of that, so it's shit. It's like a shit ton of characters that you don't care about. The other thing is this reveal. The reveal to me is too middle of the road. It's too mundane. It's too, like, too explanatory. Like, yeah. writing somebody and telling them that this was a test and you failed? Nope.
Yeah.
Fucking nope.
You know what?
But otherwise, I think Dan is on the right track in that the writing is good. It's good enough to push. But I just don't feel like there's enough room for these characters. And I don't feel like the reveal is... this reveal is super fucking cliche.
So, I think the characters, we all agree, a complete fail because the characters mean nothing, right? And yeah, I was hoping the characters would somehow define the narrator. But then it turns out that the narrator means nothing. The narrator becomes... Right. And I'd like to explore that. Like, what happens to the narrator in this story? But... because the characters mean nothing, because the narrator means nothing, the reveal is utterly without impact. It falls yeah. so flat, and therefore, the entire story is just a waste of 4,000 words.
It's a waste. You know, there is nothing... What I want to say about this is this hasn't necessarily been done, and what it feels like is... it feels like somebody took... the great 19th century Russian authors and took their great works and cut that down into 4,000 words. And like Nick said, you know, there in those novels, there's all this buildup and then you finally get to this grand reveal or whatever. And something you're so emotionally invested in this character, that character, whatever. And, and then that pays off. So,
no, that's outstanding, because what you're saying is that it hasn't been done before. So can we say that's why it's in the New Yorker, even though it's an utterly failed piece of literature?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say that it's definitely been done before. I would say that we maybe haven't read it before, but there are tens of thousands of published short stories that we've never read before. There are
sure.
probably hundreds of thousands that have been written that we've never read before. This has certainly been done before. I think that you're right. It is the stuff of great literature. Like, the payoff in great literature, this is what's funny about this story. The payoff in great literature is not going to be the reveal. The payoff is going to be getting all of those characters. Like, if this were Russian, if this was Dostoevsky or whatever, like... The payoff is getting all of these motherfuckers in the dinner, and the reader is going to be like, oh, god damn, everybody's here right now. It doesn't matter yeah. what they say afterward or what the payoff yeah. is. Like, the dinner is the payoff.
Oh, right. That's so this true of story, Tolstoy. That's Tolstoy
that's the shit
through that. And through. That's what he does.
And that's Dostoevsky, too. It's like building all these fucking inner conflicts and shit. And then it's like, and then unexpectedly, someone was gracious and invited this main character to this one waltz where he fucks everything up and blows up the fucking bourgeoisie or whatever. And it.
But you, I don't think, just, I don't think in this platform, right? In this medium, I don't think that can be done, right? You're breaking a lot of short story rules, and all rules can be broken, right? But you're breaking the character rule. You're breaking, like, backstory rule, which I fucking hate backstory more than anything. But if you have two characters and you can get backstory from context, you can do that. Like, you're breaking your reveal rule. Like, what did Padgett say? Anything that you do, whether it's wacky or whatever, it should break people's hearts. Like,
yeah,
no hearts are broken here.
No
hearts are broken.
It doesn't
here.
Happen
because just there's no transformation. Nobody's transforming, and it goes from being something that could be a really great classic if someone took a lot of time on it and crafted it well to just being something that's gonna piss people off.
Yeah,
I can't imagine what the fucking like. The slush pile, like the bottommost rung of acne-ridden, not even graduated from junior college person that read this the first time, their reaction was like, fuck, this is great. Like, what does one, the slush pile, look like? And two, what is their fucking taste? Like,
yeah, that's, and we talked about this before, is that out of all the New Yorker slush pile, this made the grade. You know, and this is a thing that we're not big wigs. We're not employed by the New Yorker, but this made the grade. And nobody had these reservations and said, maybe this is a little too ambitious.
Be for real here. I don't want to disparage anybody at the New Yorker who's reading these slush piles. I don't think that you're acting ridden and barely from junior college. I think that these people are professionals and they've read a shit ton of literature. And this is kind of the point we were talking about the other day. What am I missing? Because these, I think these people are like fucking well-educated, well-read. They're up on what's happening in literature. They have definitely more of a fucking pulse on literature than I do. I'm not reading what's getting turned out. I'm not that nose deep into the literary magazines as they are. I certainly am in there, but I'm not to that level. Like, what am I missing that someone who is well-educated and well-read and super knowledgeable about literature picks this up and says, yes? Why isn't anybody speaking up and saying, listen, Charlie, I know you mean well, but this story is a pile of garbage.
So at the end of the dinner, blah, 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 Charlie's there. Stick around, I said. We can talk. But no one lingered. No one gave Charlie a second glance. And I underlined that. And I have in all caps, and why would we?
Oh, dude, solid.
At this point in the story, why would we? He's just some fucking other buffoon who shows up that you can't be bothered to care about. Start there, and then you can build in the backstory of the shitty family and the shitty mother and the shitty happy clam and the shitty fucking chowder and the shitty Massachusetts, I guess, is where they're at. I don't know.
Did anybody take note in Dan's first reading, which I brought up right at the beginning, how Jilly was running around, and then somehow Mother later on was like, I said no children? Because I was never going to read this fucking twice. Ever. I barely made it through once. After the first page, I was skimming. But, like, why is this child running around and people are, like, cheery about this child, but then somebody else reads another child and the mother is like, oh, I said no children. Like, what's the difference there? Like, it's a plot hole, which makes me believe that the slush pile editor and every editor thereafter just read it and was like, yeah, that seems plausible. Let's put it in. It seems pretty benign. It might sell a magazine. He's famous. So
I think they went with the he's famous angle because, you know, the positioning is wrong. Where are other people in this restaurant? Is it a banquet hall?
Oh, restaurant? You thought it was a restaurant? Is it a restaurant?
For the longest time, I thought it was an Italian place.
I thought it was a fucking barbecue, like, I thought it was somebody's backyard picnic-y, nice tent, like, catered event.
The Happy Clam?
I thought the Happy Clam was... Is that where we're all at?
Yeah, we're at the Happy Clam.
Let's take note real quick then. Let's do a Richard Chapone quote. If you don't take a break in the middle of all your garbage dialogue to tell the reader where they're at periodically and remind them they're in the Happy Clam, they're just going to make up their own shit.
Exactly.
If this is all happening in the Happy Clam, that's a hashtag fail to you, Paul. I apologize. We should just have a beer, buddy. All three of us will have a beer with you, and we'll hash this story out.
I feel like the best thing for me that came out of this story are the comments that I wrote in the sidelines, in the margins, the margin area. Let's give each of us 15 to 30 seconds to read your favorite 3 to 5 marginalia comments that you made upon this story. Go, knock it out, Nick.
All right. So I've got a sentence here on some unknown page in some unknown story. But already this was unraveling. This is the family picnic, I guess. And my comment says, what's unraveling is this bullshit story. Who is whom? Who fucking cares? And I feel like that's pretty accurate.
Can I jump in there if you're done with yours?
I'll look around, but yeah, I'm pretty much done.
They're talking about the medications they take, and I've got this in landscape format so I can have it like a book, cut down on page size. I learned this from Hunter Whitworth, by the way. Hunter Whitworth, a solid gentleman.
He is a solid gentleman and a fine, fine writer. Can we say that?
Solid gentleman, fine, fine writer. So they're talking about the medications they take because they're all old and infirm and they're going to die, and that's supposed to engender some kind of emotion in me, and it just doesn't because, hey, you're about 40 years too late to the fucking party. And I just wrote across these two pages, I just don't care, in big block print. And then there's a part where the upside down cake comes out and it's really described pathetically. Not
with the cherries in business.
Not from Thoreau's standpoint, but it's described to be pathetic in the story. And I circled that paragraph and I said, it's not even sad because it's just so, underlined, expected.
Dan, you're going to unleash. I got one more. And I think this is really pertinent to what we were talking about, what Ben was talking about earlier. So I'm on page 12 of 21 in my copy of this electronically. When Charlie shows up and people are looking at him, right? And there's this like paragraph starting, I stood up, and like Jay tries to introduce Charlie to everybody, and he looks at all their faces. And I wrote, terrible sentence, but at least some fucking real tension, you know, half the goddamn way through. I think that's exactly what Ben was talking about. Like, maybe just cut all the garbage and get right to the part where shit actually matters, and then run from there. Like, just do that.
Yeah, and that requires skill as the author. You know, that requires skill as the author. And
hold on, what you just said, the opposite is what you weren't saying, and that requires skill of the author. The author needs to be skilled to write these things.
Yeah, and so I don't know this man. Maybe he has a loving family. I don't know. Donates charitably. But as an author, you write this shit. You write this shit, and then you go back through it as the fucking first editor, and you say, shit, 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 shit. Strike the story here. Shit, 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 shit. Continue. Shit, shit, shit. Continue.
That's what we hope. That's what we're all doing.
It's in the tradition of the great American short story, right? Like, this is the genre we invented as a nation. You do the short story, and you have the punch, and you go with it. So he wrote, this seems first drafty.
Well, it seems utterly without edit, right?
Exactly.
And Ben, you were commenting on that earlier, that is the legacy or the nature of the American short story process, is that you write your piece, you have a concept, you develop it, you write your piece, and then you have some phenomenal editing that comes into play that makes Raymond Carver the best possible Raymond Carver he could be, right? Well, no one made Paul Thoreau the best possible Paul Thoreau he could be.
Right. And at this point in the game, it should be like we're at this level of education and sophistication, especially with MFA programs, that you do this shit yourself. You do not send this shit out to editors. This seems like somebody sent an email to Paul Thoreau and said, hey, you've got something going on, or I like what you're doing, and please send me a short story about something. And Paul Thoreau was like, okay, sure. A day later, sent it back. Great, beautiful, love it. Next week's New Yorker, you know.
Let's talk a second about publishing, right? Like, recently publishing, getting accepted to magazines. So I was accepted to two roughly simultaneously, and one editor of a very, very respectable magazine was like, we're really interested in your... They gave me a personal form rejection. So I got the form rejection with, like, you know, this bit at the bottom that was like, so our guy... here's some feedback from a guy. to hopefully help you out, which is, you know, saying a lot in the rejection world.
Exactly.
And it specifically talked about my story, and that's all the editing I got. Hey, here are some parts that are bad. Here are some parts that are good. Try to compress, like, back to Rich again. Try to compress the parts that are bad so that the reader has less time between them and the good parts. And so I took that to heart, and I made, you know, around a 30% cut. And then the magazine that ultimately published that, they were willing to just publish the unedited version of the story.
Yeah.
And I thought, are you here to put art in the world, or are you here to fill pages? But then lots of comments came out, and there was work later, and I think just... It wasn't necessarily like that. Then they published the final edit of the story. But pre that, it just seemed like the editors from these magazines, like there were editors who were willing to put in that Lish work, that Gordon Lish work, and yeah. say, you know, I can see art in this, and I'm going to put some effort in, and I'm not going to just put it in the magazine. But then after you put the, you know, for the rest of the editors, in my opinion, like after you put the work in, they're like, yeah. So it does seem like this came without, it just seemed like, well, it's a Wednesday and we've got to print this on Thursday.
Yeah.
And here's the guy that we know is going to sell a few
this
copies.
This is name-based publishing, if you ask me. This is brand name. Brand name.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. I've actually been speaking to editors in New York who have verified with editors of the big magazines that they are staying afloat by doing name-based publishing.
Yeah, I can see that.
You buy the mag based on the names that are coming out. It's risk. It's risk-free publishing, right? Like I can keep the name of XYZ Mag alive by putting an author in there for this much money.
You know, let me highlight too before we leave this is that the New Yorker on a newsstand is $8. So you get it for subscription in your mailbox. It's drastically cheaper, but in the newsstand, you pick it up, you open up the fucking cover. You see Paul Theroux, or maybe another like high level poet that you read or respect or something like that, and you're like, "Oh, that's pretty sweet. I'm gonna get this thing." And so it's like the, I don't know, economically wise, they talk about the long tail or whatever. There's enough people out there who will just pick that up and be like, "Paul Theroux. Well, I'm gonna take this and save it and go home and have a nice chai tea and cuddle my fucking labradoodles and read this."
So you have a large percentage of people who read The New Yorker who are longtime New Yorker readers who do year after year after year, and those people are waiting for them to publish good shit again. Tom Jones used to publish it in here, like the Tom Jones of A Pugilist at Rest. Like, literature used to be fucking turned out.
Yeah.
Like, they would publish shit and people would read it and they'd be like, holy fuck, people would be brought to their goddamn knees. People who did... Like, can you imagine a reading of the story that we just read? Like, what that would look like in a room of people? The yawns, the Dan and I and you text conversation going on in the background versus, like, Tom Jones's A Pugilist at Reds or at Rest? Like, that's... They did work. What happened?
Yeah, if you go through the New Yorker's website or Esquire's website or Harper's website, and they have some like archive section, right, where you can look at, oh, here's a sample of something we published in 1987,
83.
And here's something we published in 76, and you look at those and you go, wow, that stuff is heavy weight, and then you think, what the fuck is going on in this issue? Because this Paul Theroux piece is, it's terrible. It's terrible from the standpoint of a piece of literature. This piece does not belong in the New Yorker. And the publishing industry is going sideways on this thing. And we're all suffering because of it. Because we're not exposed to those things, the pugilist at rest. We're not exposed to those things that move us in ways, whether we're whether we're fancy pants MFA grads or we're just the average person who enjoys reading something that breaks your heart. This thing is not going to break. The only reason this thing breaks my heart is that I wasted an hour or 2 hours commenting on it. Right? That's why it breaks my heart.
It's even more so. You wasted that time doing what you did in such an energetic fashion from the fucking New Yorker. Right? Like, if you read this in, like, Men's Jizz Beard Review, you'd be like, yeah, this is exactly what I would expect from that place.
Right.
But you were like, there's an expectation. There's a line that has been drawn in the sand, and this falls short of that, and that's what's heartbreak. What's heartbreak is that a platform that used to just, it was Ben's cone of ejecta, right? Of literature, right? The cone of ejecta of literature. It's not great.
Certainly. So we're gonna wrap this thing up. I'm going to get my chance to say my few comments, and then maybe one or two sentences from each of us about the totality of the story. I thought it would be entertaining for me, maybe not for the reader or the listener, but entertaining for me to say my comments without any context at all. So I'm not going to refer to the lines to which they're referring, but I said, see previous, for fuck's sake. I also said, haha, deaf to irony? No. The next one, for what, fucktard? Easy to digest because it's cliche. Also, who the fuck is Gilbert? Yay, three more characters. And then I'll finish with this one. It is, and I'll give the reference here because it says, it's the second half of a sentence, and it says, for ill will had held us together, and now there was simply indifference. And my comment was, I don't even have that for this story.
Oh, sick.
Ooh, super burn. Yeah.
So my two sentences, let me give you my two sentences, and you guys give me yours. Okay, this story is terrible. And maybe this is three sentences. Okay, this story is terrible. So many characters about who you don't care, a narrator who is so absent that you care even less, and a twist that you couldn't possibly give two shits about because see above.
I feel like that's right.
Yeah.
But in the field that I work in, it should not be a fucktard. It should be a person who experiences fucktardedness.
No way. No fucking way is that real.
So, just modify the language. So, I will say, these are the final two things about this story that I have. Too nice a tying up of the story, and the final two paragraphs were, put this about four pages back. Just eliminate the backstory. I think that's pretty basic MFA stuff where that it gets weeded out in workshop because nobody cares. And if you're a skillful author, like I've said before, you can build that in. You can build it into the story organically, and it's not forced, and it's not authorial intrusion. It's not the narrator being ham-handed. It's just part of the story.
No question. Good points, good points. Nick, do you have one or two sentences to wrap us up on this story?
I honestly just highlighted the last word in the story and wrote, fuck you. So it's more of two words instead of two sentences.
That's fantastic. And I think...
Yeah, sorry, I tried.
Entirely appropriate. So that was this week's critique. The script calls for 10 minutes. We may have taken an hour. Which I think is outstanding. It's because we're discussing the state of literature.
If I think we should do a recommended stories, in this vein, if we're gonna do, if I were to recommend a story in this, I would do what we talk about when we talk about Love by Raymond Carver. I think in a short story, it is the appropriate use of character, the appropriate use of emotion, the appropriate use of scene for a multi-character short story.
Nice. Excellent. Ben, you have anything to add on that recommended story?
You know, I fall back to my favorites, and I like this story by Miranda July. It's called Mon Plaisir. It does what a short story is supposed to do. There are two main characters, and they're like kind of secondary ones in there too, but it's full of the thing that you want from a short story. It motivates you to feel for another human being and another human being's condition, even if that human being's condition is vastly different than yours.
Outstanding. I'm going to go with almost anything from Dennis Johnson's Jesus' Son.
Christ. Oh, yeah, holy yeah. Shit.
He's got a number of stories in there that have a broad cast of characters, but they are developed. And they mean something to the narrator. And I think that's the thing that kept dragging me down in this story, is that I always wanted it to refer back to the narrator, and it never did. So Dennis Johnson does that in brilliant ways in the collection Jesus' Son. Check out any of the stories in there. You'll see a crazy cast of characters that actually have meaning and break your heart in so many ways.
That work is a piece of like great literary glory.
Oh, it's brilliance. It is. I admire
it's
it.
It's great.
Absolutely yeah. Admire it. So now this is going to be a regular feature in Wordsworthing. This podcast brought to you by Ben. You have the floor because it's Independence Day.
This podcast is brought to you by Homebrew Wine, which, in spite of our national fervor for independence and a sort of libertarian white people owning black people streak that we have going on, or had going on, not so much anymore. It's really dependent upon socioeconomic status now of who owns whom. The ability to brew not spirits, but fermented beverages in your own home. And that's a certain type of independence. And my friend Nick has informed me that the ATF, I suppose, who regulates this, has allowed for you to brew up to 200 gallons of your own home brew thing that is not distilled. And it's a beautiful thing. And
per person per household.
Per person per household.
So if you're living in a frat house, thousands.
Yes, you can brew a lot. As he pointed out, if you live in a frat house, you can brew a lot. So just cram all the people in and then brew gallons.
Homebrewed wine, independently made, brought to you by Ben Tosh. Thank you, Ben. The next segment here on Wordsworthing is WWWD. What would Wordsworth do? So the reason why this comes about is because we learned during our education process that Wordsworth and his good friend Samuel Taylor Coleridge, both well-known artists, writers, poets, used to go on long walks together. And across the course of miles and days, they would discuss all things literature. And through so doing, they would land upon ideas, inspiration, desperation, probably misery, and what have you. Nick, if you've got something, if you've gone for a walk, if you've said yes to something, maybe share with our listeners what Wordsworth would have done. And yet you found yourself in such a place, and you did what?
This is really distracting with Buddy Jesus in his tie-dye shirt moving shit across the universe. It's so hard. Like, with the sound and the fucking effort that's going on over there, and I feel like the drama. God damn it, I say yes to your drama. I say yes to your drama, Ben. Here, I'm gonna give you a what would Wordsworth do moment. So I go to Ben's apartment one night, right? Okay. And his kids are visiting. We're in Alaska. We're in Palmer. And it's exactly like what's going on right now. Okay? Except for they're going to go for a camping trip, like, the following day at some point. And there's this, like, super tense moment about dinner, which we've all discussed. Dinner is the root of all fucking evil. And they're, like, deciding on what's going to be dinner. And so I'm like, guys, I can fucking make dinner. So I go into the kitchen to make dinner, and I'm making dinner because you say yes. You say yes, right? Like, I can fix this. I can fucking make dinner, yeah?
Absolutely. Yes, you can.
So you're like, yeah, I can make dinner. I'll fucking make dinner. So I don't interrupt their family. Their family just goes on about their business, and I'm in the kitchen making dinner, trying to find the... Oh, he froze. Trying to find the fucking pans and trying to find the ingredients. So I crush dinner there, and every time I turn around, it's that most, like, awkward, thick family tension that you've been a part of, that I've been a part of, that I've created.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So good.
That he's in right now.
So good.
So in the midst of all this fucking tension where they're supposed to be packing their bags and doing their things, and, like, I'm in their house, and I'm like, what the fuck? Like, okay, yeah, yeah, I said I'd make dinner. So I'm, like, gathering all the ingredients and making the fucking... And I was like, I'm going to make burritos. And I just hear, like, they're not going to eat any of that shit. None of the shit you're putting in there, they're going to eat. And I'm like, I'm just going to make it. So I'm like, I take leftovers from the fridge, and I'm cutting shit up, and I'm making fucking burritos. Like, I'm in the kitchen, and then I'm, like, dragging them. I'm like, guys, come in the kitchen. And so we're, like, cutting shit up, and they're cutting it up, and they're frying the shit in the pan. And we make these burritos. And then they fucking eat them completely. And it was, like, the most accommodating yes. Like, yes, I will relieve you of all of this tension that I have been a part of. If someone a stork swooped in and delivered a yes to me, like, I would take that yes.
That is absolutely beautiful. And I think that is unquestionably what Wordsworth would do. I love it.
For sure. You got to be in the awkward.
Hey, listen,
right?
That is a fantastic first WWWD for the Wordsworthing podcast. And thank you, Nick, for sharing that. We'll have more of those every episode to come. And now we move into...
Dude, I miss stuff.
You miss nothing. Now we move into the final segment of the Wordsworthing podcast, which we're just simply calling Snap Edit. Each episode, one podcaster from the team here is going to read a recently penned piece, very short, and the other two will give a snap edit of that with the idea that through this dialogue, we are identifying the things that we enjoy about the short story format, the things that excite a reader, the things that we all need to work upon. And hopefully over the course of time, Wordsworthing will produce better art out of each of us, and perhaps even our listeners as well. So Mr. Tosh volunteered to be the first victim of the snap edit, and he's going to read from his recently penned piece. Ben, take it away.
This excerpt is from a novel that is in its drafty stage, and it's about a young man named Augie who has joined the Marine Corps, and he's on leave to visit his mother. And the stage is South Mississippi. She picked him up from the Jackson International Airport. He's dressed toolishly. And she brooks no shit. He looked over at her driving. She was old, a fact that Augie actively processed for the first time in his life. When did that happen? She still wore nurse's scrubs religiously, even though the closest she'd ever been to that profession were her three trips to the hospital to birth her sons. The unlit cigarette rested in her fingers that were, Augie noticed, lumpy-knuckled, not quite gnarled, but on the precipice of that description. The skin of her hands was wrinkly in a large spot, maybe an old bruise smeared across the hairless back of her right hand. Flesh dangled from the upper arm, jiggling softly when the car rolled over potholes. Her neck had taken the unstoppable turn toward turkeyish. Her hair, following her calling as a stylist, she maintained in an impeccable and un-old ladylike straight-bottom lime cut that she dyed every 2 weeks. Changing the hue with the seasons, and for that winter, she'd chosen a deep black. The hair framed a face marred by an almost pack-a-day cigarette addiction. Her eyes were the liveliest thing about her, darting about like birds as she piloted the car. Fuck me, Augie thought. You hungry? His mother asked. Had snacks on the plane, Augie said. I ain't talking about that. I mean real food. They look to not be feeding you any better than what they were before. I'm fine, Mama. What about you? Augie's mother waved her cigarette dismissively. Where's Jake and Hunter? In the trunk, his mother laughed. How've they been? Ornery? The same? I don't know. Augie looked out the window. Maybe I am a little hungry. They got the same type places out there they got here? It's a little different, but mostly the same. I don't get out much. California. You know, I used to dream about going out there when I was a little girl. The abrupt turn in conversation surprised Augie. He searched his memory but could find no instance of her ever broaching subjects outside of the directly experiential, and often then the selection was further limited by the imminently temporal. If it wasn't a fire that needed extinguishing right that minute, it wasn't important enough to dwell on, much less discuss. Augie thought maybe the drive to Jackson had given her time to ruminate upon the past. You never said anything about it. Yeah, typical kid stuff. Run away and join the circus thinking, you know? Go out and be some movie star or something. The lies you gotta tell yourself to get through the day. She steadied the wheel with her knee and lit her cigarette. Exhaling the smoke, she continued. Learned real quick that it wasn't going to happen when you came along. But, she paused to smoke again. I suppose everything worked out best. I can't even imagine how messed up my life would have gotten to be if I actually made it out there. What did you want to go for? I just said it. No, I mean, what made you want to leave home? You never knew your grandpa, or you know. There's a reason we didn't ever visit them. I thought they just died, I guess. No, alive, and well as far as I can know, both of them. In Arkansas, last I heard, and didn't want to hear word one from me. That's fine, too. They'll be dead soon enough. Trash it up, gents.
Yeah, so this is an interesting exercise because we're going off of something that was read to us aloud. I don't have a printed copy of it. Nick, I know you apologies. Don't as well.
Yeah, no.
Which is interesting. So, Nick, why don't you start with what's good?
I don't know if I can pick good apart, right? Like, I just took snap notes. Like, this is snap edits. We should do snap notes. I've got about a half a page here. The nurse's clothes bit was really good. It was a really good detail into the character. Like, I wondered why she'd only been there that many times. Like, why she was wearing nurse's clothes again. Like you had said, like, the way that it was brought to me was a way that it was done a lot, and but she had no reason to. That was good. It had Ben Tosh vocabulary, as always. Pick and choose where you want to fight your battles in that regard. I think you could dial it back, not too much. Just don't place them in the wrong place. unold, unold. Like, don't, so many descriptors. At some point, cut one. Unold is probably one. The hair season thing was so personable in the mom character. Like, this season, it was black. Or whatever. However you did that, I thought that was really clever. Because it tied some form of external validation of a personal choice to a season or to a time period, and that is like, that's really good. A really clear detail that I found to be great. The dialogue was good. The dialogue, I felt, so you had this really long intro of him describing how old she was, which I thought could have been cut by Infinity. But the dialogue afterward felt like, okay, I'm in the seat and I'm on this, I'm in the car, I'm the, you know, the fly in the window of this car who's listening to this shit, and that was fantastic. So when you hit dialogue, it was cruise control of really good shit. The dreaming thing, this like, I had this dream that I would such and such in California thing, that seemed kind of authorial. And in your dialogue, you have not, so I've done this a lot in the past. I've read a lot of other authors that do it. Your dialogue on paper is grammatically correct. When read aloud, doesn't have the flow of natural dialogue. You include non-contractioned phrases. You say want to instead of wanna. If you're going to do that, then the character itself has to, like, the character has to push that solid rigidity to a form of rules. And in this case, in this case, I'm getting JFF driving down the road, smoking a cigarette. And she says all the things she wants to say, you know, it's a wanna, it's a whatever, you know, it's all of that shit. It doesn't have that, like, firm rigidity to grammatical language, which you adhere to in all your non-dialogue phrases. So that's right. Just my snap edits.
Go.
That's really good. So I would certainly echo a lot of that. But question one for me right out of the gate was the stance of the narrator, the psychic distance of the narrator. Augie is the named character whose POV I think we're supposed to have, but there's, to me, a little bit of unevenness in the beginning between where the narrator is coming from and where Augie is coming from. And I noticed that very specifically at the line, this was early on, where it says, Augie noticed, .. I don't remember exactly what came after that, but...
Yeah.
Did we need Augie notice? Because then that felt very intrusive. Like, at this point, we believe that we're in Augie. So do we have to hear that Augie noticed? That was one thing I noticed.
That's a really good point.
You know, okay, I want to interject here because that is really good, and that's a thing I've struggled with. And so I've gone through maybe half of this novel, editing it, and I've... Most of my comments say authorial, you know, and they just have a line through it. And it's not authentic to the voice that is Augie, which should be the narrator slash character.
So you've got this third person thing going, right? But it's so solid that I don't think you need the Augie noticed. I don't think you need those things. I think your third person is positioned just right, so that psychic distance is correct, and it's when you say things like Augie noticed that you break that. You have some beautiful physical descriptions. The thing about her old bruise, Nick mentioned the hair. Hair is fantastic. But then it stuck out to me within that realm of the wonderful physical piece. You talk about the turkey neck, and that's cliche.
Okay, yeah. Valid.
I found your dialogue to be so excellent because of its choppiness, of that it's got an element of no dialogue. It's not a ton of that, but it has enough of it. And what your characters do in the space of the dialogue is they perform dialogue through physical acts.
Right.
So you have dialogue happening through a physical, like lighting a cigarette or looking out a window or something like that. It's part of the dialogue, but no words are said. That's really well done.
Right.
So you've got essentially physical amplifications to the dialogue, and I really like that. The pacing is really nice, especially through the dialogue sections. It's got this choppy thing, which you punctuate with some, as Nick called it, Ben Tosh vocabulary.
Yeah.
There is a sentence, though, that starts with the abrupt turn in conversation, ... Following that sentence, the vocabulary becomes too much. You're like deep into Brogans at that point.
Yeah.
And that is too big of a break of the rhythm. The rhythm is so good up until that point. And then as soon as you dive into something that sounds like, wait, somebody else wrote this sentence. This wasn't the same guy.
Right. Yeppers.
You can use, like, you're so good at the juxtaposition of, like, you've got poor Mississippi people here, right? Smoking cigarettes, driving their shitty cars, whatever. But then you blanket it in some real erudite, beautiful language. But if you go too far that way, then it's like a sine wave, right? You've got the peaks and the valleys and the peaks and the valleys. And if you break that rhythm, you like one valley is way too deep, one peak is way too high, you shatter the whole thing.
Yeah.
So you got to kind of be careful of that. But Ben, overall, it's very, very visual. Nick made some good comments on the using the contractions and that sort of thing. But in some ways, I do think that's you, and you can't get totally away from that. You can't become totally not you in your writing.
Right.
You have to. There's something about Ben Tosh that you have to write in a way that speaks to a higher learning to even the most mundane character, to a guy who's digging ditches, who's shoveling shit, still has some of the poet in him.
No, I feel like what Dan's saying has credibility. I feel like it does not apply to the dialogue of characters that are not. So he's pointing out of who is the narrator and who is the character in this. That's 100% legit. Like, what stance are you standing in when you make this fucking call from the mountain? Is it going to be the narrator? Or is it going to be the the main character? And if you make that determination, either one of those doesn't have a say on what the dialogue of the other characters say, because that is part of their personality. You might have this like wobbly armed mother who is erudite, as Dan says, and maybe that's her character, but you were going to be true to her and not true to your writing. Every other non-dialogue portion should be as erudite as what your narrator / main character or whatever, whoever is telling the story, like everything should be at that level of vernacular and vocabulary, but all the other characters need to have dialogue that is specific and characterizing to them.
You know, I want to say this, like the dialogue with the characters is good and is solid like that. And the problem with this has been normalizing like the author narrator thing that's going on. And I've excised large portions because I was like, authorial, it's shit, you know, I wrote it, but it's shit, you know, because it's not genuine to the characters, it's not genuine to the narrator, and I've made notes all across my stuff, like tone, language, you know, tone and language. Like, this is not a something that these people would say, or in the way that they would say it, or in the nature that they would say it. And so that's very...
Okay, but don't forget that that's when it comes out of their mouth, right? The narrator is something else. So be true to your narrator, and then be true to them when it's coming out of their mouths.
Right, and so the thing is, you know, getting to that point, like language and knowing when the author like comes in, because it did it a lot in this draft, and it's awful. Like, when you see it like printed out, you're like, holy shit, this is terrible.
Are you first or third person here?
It's third person. And so the things where there are authorial, it's all first.
Yeah.
Person.
Okay.
And it's couched in third person, but it's totally first person. It's me saying blah blah blah, I did this, all shit, blah blah.
Hey, so Ben, I wanted to offer just one other thing about the narrator versus the character, etc. And I would look in two places. I would suggest looking at both Jim Harrison and Cormac McCarthy. I think they both do that. They both have some really nice language, and it doesn't come off as fully authorial because their characters remain their characters. Their narrator remains the narrator, and you don't have that like spilling over between the two, and you can silo the language pieces in a way that is really palatable to the reader. That's my opinion.
I think you are 100% correct.
Yeah, we just wrapped up Ben's snap critique, which was very well presented. Ben, thank you for the opportunity to take a look at that. Nick, you had tremendous words of wisdom, and I contributed the occasional under my breath belch.
Oh, that's garbage. You did kind of the main piece, which is figure out who the fuck is talking in this fucking piece.
Well, somebody has to be this somebody talking.
Absolutely. People have to know who the fuck is the fucker.
Who the fuck is the fucker?
Yeah, for sure.
So last little moment we have here within the confines of the Words Worthing podcast are a few words of wisdom from the beard. Two of the three of us have beards, so this assignment can actually shift from person to person. And I may, in fact, grow a beard just to be part of that crowd.
Do it. I feel like that's my words of wisdom, is like, put some hair on your face, you son of a fuck.
There we go. Words of wisdom from the beard. Well, we're going to just cut out with a little outro music that will pretty much confirm how much you enjoyed this episode of Wordsworthing. Benjamin Tosh, Nick DeGuerra, Dan Mickelson, gentlemen, thank you. It was outstanding. Many more to come.